When you have a foot in two continents, have finished your education, and have to find a place in this world, you have to make decisions. Today, we talk to Luca Alessandrini about building his new food business, importing artisanal food products from Italy. It's interesting, and it's on tip of the tongue. Welcome to Tip of the Tongue, a podcast on the Nitty Grits Network, where we explore the intersection of food and drink and museums. This is Liz Williams. We're here today with Luca Alessandrini. His company, Italo Americano Inc., is helping to bridge the barriers to entry into the American market for traditional artisanal food companies in Italy. Welcome, Luca.
Thank you so much for having me, Liz. I'm excited to chat.
So tell me a little bit about what made you decide to create this company.
Yeah, so this company is, I would say, a little bit of a reflection of my life and my experiences in life. My father is Italian from a small town called San Sepolcro in the Tuscan region of Italy. And my mom is from New Orleans, Louisiana. And so my whole life has been a little bit of a back and forth. And then through that back and forth, it's been a lot of sharing of traditions and products, both from New Orleans or America to Italy and vice versa. And so, you know, growing up and as I've gotten older, I've kind of honed in on this passion I have for sharing what goes on and the craft of each of these places. And over the last 8 months, I've been living in Italy and started to really get to know some of these artisanal producers of food goods, specifically anywhere from chocolates, olive oils, snacks. And as I got to talk with them, you know, it always comes back to, oh, you have American citizenship. Oh, you know, America, it's our dream. It's our dream to sell there or to at least see, you know, the American market, see America, as most of these individuals have not ever even traveled there. And so that led me to kind of double down on both a passion and a problem I saw in my life experience.
Well, I understand. I'm certainly not a person who's lived in Italy ever just as travel, only travel there. But I know growing up in New Orleans, it's impossible to not care about food. But then if you grew up with any kind of a foot in the Italian-American community here, then you have that other side that you also know about food. And so you just can't escape it. I mean, food just becomes a central part of your life, more than just fuel. You know, it's the conviviality and the sharing and all of those sorts of things and the bonds created over food that are very, very important, both because you're from New Orleans and because of the Italian heritage.
I couldn't agree more. And as I like to say, you know, New Orleans is the most European city in the U.S. So it just felt right. A lot of the traditions that we do share, even with my small town in Tuscany, that I feel right at home in New Orleans and vice versa. And so growing up in the house, you know, dinner at the table with the family was a thing. And for me today, even going to university in New Orleans at Tulane, I can't tell you the amount of nights where I would have rather just have a nice group dinner and cook for everyone than maybe go to one of the bars downtown. So, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your background. Besides being Italian American and growing up part of your life in Italy and part of it in New Orleans, what kind of experience do you have? What did you study at Tulane, for example?
Yeah, so I was in the business school. I got my degree in marketing and then Italian history. So I think an appropriate combination. And, you know, I think an important thing to note in terms of my experience just in my life is I grew up, my father is an artist. And so he's a sculptor and a painter. And a lot of my passion for getting into marketing and maybe the business world was a conclusion I had at a young age, which was one artist in the house is enough. And so I focused on how to help him, right? And how to share his art with the world. And a lot of my experiences before the professional world revolved around working with my dad and learning about that art world, which in a lot of ways was as well an exchange of Italian culture here in America. After graduating Tulane, I moved to New York City, following, I guess the dream that was taught to me, not necessarily my own passion, but I worked in finance in New York for a little over 5 years, where but before taking this kind of leap of, I don't want to be waking up when I'm 50 with the same feeling that there's something else out there, some other passion that would feel a little more appropriate for my skill set.
So how are you going about this? How are you deciding this is the right market for these companies that you're involved with? And how do you determine whether they can scale to the necessary size to make it worthwhile for them to come here? How are you kind of taking it apart and helping the Italian companies make an intelligent decision about whether they are right for the American market?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a big learning process, not only for myself at this time, but for the Italian brand. So, step one is sharing the insights that I find in different markets. So I'm currently in New York, and we've been spending most of our days visiting not only distributors, but retail locations where there could be a potential fit for these products. And before making any decision or signing any maybe offer sheet for these brands, we want to deliver those insights back to them. And the reason for that is we want them to, for the first time, really understand what the American market is, what they want, what works, what doesn't, provide them those details so that maybe they can make modifications to, something as simple as the size of their bag of chips, right? That could work better or maybe make those margins better and make it more realistic for them to enter the market. And the service that we're offering is, in a lot of ways, a consultation for them as well, right? Because it's not always going to work. It's not always going to be a right fit. And as you mentioned, in terms of supply, right? I think the focus for a lot of these artisanal brands is smaller scale, a higher price point, and a more curated shopping experience. And that requires a very personal relationship. As on the retail side, I think, as we all know, these shops are independently owned. Right. So my goal is to kind of form the bridge between the relationship of a small curated retailer in this example and the artisanal producer in Italy who gets to see his product appreciated and tried in America.
So how do you work with the company? In other words, you're telling me about it kind of generally, but let's take one of the companies. You pick the product, and you don't even have to name the company if you don't want to, but just pick a product and tell us, these are the things that we have to look at to make a decision as to whether or not it makes sense to come to even try to come to America, because I know you don't want them to try and not be successful. So,
Yeah, that's a great kind of mental exercise to go through that I've been going through a lot. So happy to share. Yeah, one of the companies is called Truffle Italia. They're a small, truffle company, and they started off their business selling fresh truffles from the Tuscan and Umbrian regions of Italy to restaurants and private clients across the world. And what's really cool about them, and it was a business that was completely created on Instagram, meaning the founder, Dami, he realized, hey, I have a network of guys who go out and hunt for truffles, right? They have fresh truffles, but when they go to sell them, if they're not eating them themselves, is they have to go through a two, three, sometimes four brokers before it gets to a final client, right? So they sell to a regional broker who sells to a national one who then sells to a EU broker or American broker. Anyway, so what if we skip all those steps, ensure that the truffle hunters are getting paid more, and we can actually deliver a fresher product to the consumer? So that was how that business was founded. And now they've expanded to making snacks that include a truffle popcorn and truffle chips, which sounds pretty simple. But a unique part of their product, before I get into the details, is that it's not with truffle oil, it's with actual truffle extract. So the flavor is much, much more similar to an actual truffle than what we have kind of come to know, especially in America, with this exaggerated truffle oil that you can smell
Right.
from a mile away.
Right.
Anyway, so right away we sat down and we spoke about what are they, what is your brand, what is your model in Italy, right? So let's see if there can be any synergies before redesigning the wheel here. And in Italy, their product is a higher price point product, so selling anywhere from 6 to 9 euro for basically a can of chips. And we're not talking a large size here. But the reason for this is that it's sold in boutique wine shops, really with the goal of being part of your aperitivo. And that's probably the thing I miss most about being back in America, is that there's no culture for aperitivos. And so you can have a little snack, and as Italians, you should number one rule, never drink without something to eat. And so this was served with a champagne or a nice light wine, white wine. And so already there, right, we're seeing a little bit of a cultural difference, like, right? Because that doesn't exist necessarily in America, right? That more common, evening little snack and drink.
And when we eat earlier anyway.
Yeah,
So.
exactly. Your dinner's about aperitivo time. So, yeah. And so, right away, right, we're talking about a cultural difference. Like, how can we place this differently, right? How can we frame this product differently in the routine of the average American? And as well as understanding that the price point is higher, and there's reasons for that, right? The can they use is more expensive. The printing of the labels are more expensive. The process of extracting these truffles and flavoring the popcorn and chips is more expensive. So the price point obviously comes out higher. So, the average American, when they're thinking of snacks, they're probably spending a couple bucks on some Lay's chips, right? So that's already another kind of hill we have to climb.
And they're eating more of the chips.
Oh yeah, way more. That's the probably most common point of feedback so far, is where can I get the bigger bag, the family size bag. So those are the things we're working through right now. And at this point, just as the example with Truffle Italia, we're having conversations with specialty retailers. As I said, I'm in New York right now doing that, distributors, to understand where this could fit into their offering and what they're seeing in the market. Because, when we're kind of forming a partnership with these Italian companies, I try to be as clear as possible that I would love to work with someone who is flexible, meaning they're willing to learn. And if you do want to sell in America, there's a good chance we have to make some modifications to a list of attributes that we just discussed.
Right. And so this is even before anybody worries about the labeling and other kinds of issues that they might have to comply with American law.
Exactly. That's another headache that's just awaiting us around the corner after we get kind of through of where we're going to place and how we're going to brand this product, right? And so just taking a step back from, the business that I'm starting right now is, I think, brand management services in the US for this company, and then export management services for this company. And those kind of fit side by side, but each kind of comes at its own pace.
Okay, so you have to do that for a variety of different products. So you might have chocolate, you might have olive oil, you might have all of these different things to deal with. How can you just be so general in what your product, what you do for them?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think it comes back to the original problem that I saw on the ground in Italy talking to these brands is that there is no starting point for them to get into America. And I am not claiming to be their whole American team, right? And that's not my service, and I'm not capable of providing everything you need to sell and work in America, right? But you know, Italy is a high trust society, right? And especially in the business world. So, number one, I'm offering them someone who speaks both languages, has dual citizenship, and can be in both places, right? I'm offering them the insights that I have in the American market, the language barriers, you know, that we're hopping over because many of them don't speak English, have never been to America. And if they wanted to, they can maybe take a trip every couple of years to actually be here. So I view it more as opening the door, laying the blueprint for to help them execute in America. And if I need to help them hire someone who is actually more on the ground doing sales or someone who is more a food law professional to connect them with, I see myself as kind of connecting the dots rather than kind of creating from the ground up.
Right. So tell me a little bit about what you think you're learning about the American market by doing this.
That's a great question, and every day that answer changes. I think there's such a unique on a local level, on a state level, even on national level, the relationships between importers, distributors, and retailers. It seems so far that everyone has a unique strategy and a unique definition for each of those kind of key components of getting a product from producer, especially when we're talking about importing to the final consumer. What we see importers, right, who focus as importing as strictly a service. You pay this amount, I will get it through customs. I will try to minimize the taxes on these goods. And then when it's landed, you take it away from there. We don't really care what it is as long as it fits, you know, our experience. Then we on the other side, we have importers who act as curators, right? These are the importers who are almost always signing exclusive deals with brands, meaning I will be your importer for the United States, but I'm turning around and I'm providing value to distributors who know me as a curated importer, being the person who has that olive oil brand, the one who discovers maybe the new pasta brand, right? And they act as a curator and provide that value on top of just importing. And then we move down to distribution, and that's a whole nother kind of ballpark when it comes to how many SKUs each distributor carries, how focused they are, and the incentives behind their sales teams. So I don't want to have to jump in too much to that, but I think that's really what, in terms of the American market, is understanding, you know, what direction to focus in to get these products to the consumer, but understanding that there's no real solid playbook or rule book, I may say.
So let's go back to the truffles and the potato chips and the popcorn. So you said that the truffle people are using an extract. Do they actually produce the extract?
So they're recent, yes, but so a lot of the extract comes from these smaller truffles or truffle shavings that they can't sell, which I think is a pretty cool model. No, zero waste. But once you hit a certain amount of volume, you need to start buying from other people those scraps, right? And they work with a team outside of Florence who does that extraction process. So through them, they can also acquire additional truffles to extract.
Well, I was just wondering whether instead of actually selling the product that's been infused, if they actually sell the infusion might be more direct and would be, because to me, the idea of shipping popcorn already made to America is like, really? You know, the expense of the shipping just adds so much to popcorn that if you could send the infusion, which is so much smaller but denser, and then make the popcorn in America and infuse the popcorn in America, it would be a much cheaper less expensive process. And then you're making it basically in America. And so a lot of the rules are going to be a lot easier to deal with. And so if you partnered with a popcorn manufacturer, you might do something different, you know? It's just a thought.
I think that's a great, you're 10 steps ahead of the game. And I think that's a great path to explore. Hopefully in the coming months, we are able to get a grasp on where this product fits in the US to understand demand and eventually form relationships like that. I think that's great.
I mean, my idea is if it sells for 6 euros for a small can in Italy, it would have to sell for $10 or $12 or maybe more in America. And so you're creating a barrier in price from the beginning, but you might be able to sell the extract in a way that made the price of the final product more acceptable, or more ordinary.
Yeah, I think so. I agree completely. I think there is, we're working on a couple different options right now in terms of, price point experimenting in different regions. So as of now, the popcorn's in one retailer across the state of Texas and one retailer, a smaller boutique retailer that's located in Manhattan in Brooklyn. And the relationships on the retail side hopefully can deliver some insights into that as well, right? Is starting off with kind of a limited retail presence, but using it as a case study for us to understand where our price point comes, where demand peaks in relationship to that.
Yeah, but you've already got it into the country, so you know the costs and all of that, even though the volume may be smaller than you ultimately want it to be, which maybe would reduce cost a little bit.
Yeah, and I think what you just kind of taking a step back, what you make a fantastic point of just price point in general, right? That's something we're going to be working up against in all of the products that we serve and partner with, the brands we partner with. Number one, because they're artisanal, right? It's not a huge production, no matter which way you slice it. And as well, in America, a lot of the CPG, food brands are value brands. They are not higher end. They are not luxury. There isn't a huge appetite on the surface level for expensive, finer goods when it comes to simple things like the pastas, like a chip, like a chocolate. When you're used to buying a Hershey's bar for a couple bucks, selling one for 15 just because it's Italian isn't, it isn't a walk in the park. It's not impossible because there is value behind that price, but it's a category in which the American market is not too used to. Obviously, it is. I don't want to make a blanket statement here, but it's just not too used to spending that little bit extra on that category.
Right. But people will spend a lot for chocolate if it's little individual chocolates in a pretty box,
Exactly. There's always a way around it. I can promise you that. But if it's not a big pack of Doritos, it might be a little more challenging.
So I think that this has to be a kind of a problem just in general, because you always are now in a position to create a market for products that require maybe a different way of thinking about food. Now, that doesn't mean that America has the right way to think about food, but I mean, you're stuck with what's here. And so, without changing the entire way we think about food in America, which could do with its own overhaul, but you're in a position to try to interpret this market to another culture, another way of thinking about food. And how can that ever be understood? Especially even if you understand it and think it's nuts, you're not going to necessarily want to change what you do. I mean, I could see a kind of a stubborn streak of this is the right way.
Well, that's exciting, right? That's why I'm so happy to be doing this, and what gets me up in the morning excited is that, there's a huge blue ocean space, right? That hasn't been discovered, and we're not aiming to necessarily go head to head with, Lay's potato chips, right? We don't want to be next to them necessarily in the store, right? We don't want to be in the same household necessarily as, the extra big bag of Lay's. We want to find unique ways to not only place the product, but tell the story. I think that for me is what gets really exciting, is understanding how we can translate these unique stories. Because the reason I'm doing this is when you get to go see on the factory floor of this chocolate company, or go truffle hunting with this, truffle company in Italy, see the passion they have for it, the care they put into it, and how much of a science it is for them. And bring that back and translate it into a digestible message and story for the American market. And I'll give you a quick example of something I think exciting, and in the way I like to think about it is, a couple months ago, we had a wine company reach out to me, of saying, how can we get this wine, seen in the US? And the wine, for context, is a premium release by this vineyard, by this cellar, outside of Florence. It's a Merlot Cabernet blend that's been aged for 3 years. They put a lot of care. There's only 1,200 bottles produced, but they had an artist do the label for it, and it became kind of an intersection between, art and an exclusive wine release. So there's a very deep story behind not only the wine, but the artist who did it and the inspiration behind it. And so we sat down, we're thinking, how can we place this, right? Because the price point is in the $500 range for a case of three. So not everyone's just going to pick up, your barefoot bottle like this. And we said, well, let's focus on placing this wine in art galleries, right? Let's place it as an art piece rather than trying to compete with the Brunellos of the world. What's take a unique, placement to this, but like a unique storyline where you're separating outside of the crowd and also maybe delivering value to exactly the person who appreciates art versus the person who's just looking at a wine from Italy or from Europe in general.
And so, is there a problem with the art galleries having to have a liquor license in order to sell the wine?
So they're at the end of the day, the loophole there is that they're displaying it, and then the transaction would occur actually directly with whoever imported it,
Okay.
or excuse me, import slash distributed. So it's a little bit of loophole. It's really more of a showing mechanism. And then there's obviously, as galleries gouge artists for 50, 60% commission, there's obviously payment made, but it acts as more of a vehicle for promotion, right? I kind of the same way of like being in that perfect middle shelf at the grocery store, but at checkout, you're checking out with the importer distributor, not the store. Yeah.
I see. Okay, well that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Well, so are there any particular companies that you are approaching yourself that you would just love to, and not necessarily their names, but the kinds of companies that you think would be an easy fit in the US?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of opportunity in the sweets space. I think when we think of even some of the more original outside of just the panetta, the chocolates of the world, or smaller delectable treats, I think there's a lot of opportunity there in the American market, because I think there is an appreciation as that goes along with more of a willingness to pay for a price point, or a higher price point for specialty sweets. And yeah, I think every day I'm learning th new things, so I can't claim to have a perfect answer right now. I do think that I will answer your question in a little bit more unique way, which is that I do think eventually there is an opportunity to provide this service, and or even not even consider it a service, but to have conversations by flipping the model on its head, which is you're a retailer in the US, whether it be commercial, maybe we'll specify, a specialty food store. How do I stand out from the crowd, right? Because there all the stores around me are using probably the same distributors, so our product pool is fundamentally very similar. But like, who can I reach out to get a unique fine Italian good or a food product into my store so that my customers are happy and I'm not just offering the same, tomato sauce, anchovies. Like, I think we all see the same brands at the end of the day in a lot of these stores. And how can I tell a better story and develop a relationship? So provide with my clients. So providing that service on the flip side to the American market by pointing them in the right direction or even reaching out on their behalf to get a product to them.
And as we had talked before, I also think that showing them how to use the product in other ways than just the traditional, Italian food way, so that they just need it, they have to have it because they can use it in everything that they do. I think that's also important so that it expands the use of the thing so that
Yeah,
they need it.
I can't wait for our first demonstration at SoFab. And we'll have some cool recipes that combine New Orleans tradition, Italian tradition, and Creole tradition.
That'll be fun. Well, Luca, thanks so much. This has been a great conversation, and we'll have to check in with you in a little while and see how things are going. So tell us about, do you have a website yet?
The website is coming up. I will just link to my Instagram as of now because we haven't got all of the logos and things for our website quite done. We're really at the first inning here, so I'm excited to tell the story and check back as you mentioned. But my Instagram is Italo_Americano, so you can find me there, and I'll be always promoting Italian products. And if anyone wants to chat, I'm always happy to schedule some time.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Liz.
Thanks for listening to Tip of the Tongue, a part of the Nitty Grits Network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Subscribe to this and other food and drink related podcasts at southernfood.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to keep up with me, Liz Williams, you can subscribe to my Substack newsletter, also called Tip of the Tongue, for more information about this podcast, recipes, and just what is going on. I'm Liz Williams. Thanks for listening.